You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this live episode of the Spice Bags podcast. My name is Dee Laffin. This is Mae Chin. Hi. And this is Blanca Valencia, and we're the co-hosts of the Spice Bag podcast. For anyone who doesn't know who we are, we're an award-winning podcast that focuses on the international community in Ireland around food. We've often interviewed people from with focuses from different countries like Venezuela, Brazil, Poland, and just getting to know people who are here as immigrants originally to the country or from mixed heritage, but who are all part of the same community as we are, and that we all here focusing on food and what we love most, which is eating. So we're delighted to be part of Samhain Festival, and thank you so much to the guys for asking us to come down to do this. So we are going to be talking to Lorena and Alan Krauss from Kahlua Castle. But first of all, we just thought in the spirit of the festival, we would have a little discussion about Samhain as a festival and the foods, I suppose, that are associated with it, but also with Halloween and with Días los Muertos, excuse my really bad...
Todos los Santos.
Yeah, and Todos los Santos. You know, festivals and I suppose that focus on this time of year, which is when the veil between, I suppose, us and the spirits and that kind of world is at its thinnest. And we are heading into winter, heading into darkness. So that's what we're here to talk about. So we're going to do a little bit about that now. I just wanted to let you guys know, I don't know if you know, that Samhain in Celtic lore, which I suppose where it comes from, is the year is divided into two halves, and with dark and light. And obviously the dark half begins at the sunset on November 1st, which is Samhain. And the cycle ends when the light half begins on the 1st of May, on the sunset on the 1st of May. And that's Beautana, which is the other festival that we celebrate here in Ireland. And both festivals are closely linked in general, but, you know, Samhain is seen as the most important. And in the olden days, they extensive preparations were made for sharing of a communal feast. Did you guys know that, about feasting around Samhain, or have you ever heard of that?
I was so surprised, and it reminded me of being Chinese, and the way we celebrate our dead is always through feasting.
Yeah.
So I was a detail that, you know, I was new to, and I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, apparently to the communal feast was to kind of included for the dearly departed were the honors of the guests of honor, I should say, and to enable them to come and go freely, all the doors and windows were left unlatched. A special cake was made exclusively for their consumption, and a certain amount of other food was set aside for them. And I think you see that in the Mexican, that's what they do, isn't
it? Yeah, I think last week I was at the Mexican embassy celebrating Día de los Muertos, and different communities around Ireland had done the altars or tombs where you honor a dead person. And some of them were famous people. Normally you find Frida Kahlo, the painter, is very common. But there was also a pilot who landed safely in Ireland and saved a lot of people who was being honored. But they have ofrendas, like these food offerings that you have on the tombs or on the altars, like pan de muerto. But They had everything, tortillas. Lily Ramirez from Picado also had an altar dedicated to her dad and to her father-in-law. So like very emotional, But that aspect of food that, for example, in Spain, we don't bring food to the tombs at all.
No, we don't do that here either. And I suppose in Ireland, we may not, even though we're here to celebrate Samhain, this beautiful festival, but in general in Ireland, people celebrate Halloween more so. And that comes from the States. But we were talking earlier that what is celebrated as Halloween in the US actually comes from Ireland. Yeah. So all the Irish people going over to the States brought Samhain over, they used to carve turnips, not pumpkins. Yeah. And all of those traditions kind of over the years have turned into Halloween. Would you have known that the States growing up?
Absolutely not. But, you know, again, reading about Samhain, just this idea of people disguising themselves and dancing and singing and going door to door, which I feel like is the origin of trick or treat. All very interesting. Yeah. I mean, I have to confess that only 4 days ago did I know how to pronounce Samhain. So that's my knowledge.
I mean, it's a tricky one.
This is somebody who speaks Chinese, but she can't pronounce Samhain. You need to go to Irish school.
I know.
And was there anything like that in Chinese culture? Or
We always have ghosts and demons and hungry spirits and ancestors. We have a ghost day that's not in November. It's actually usually at the end of August or the beginning of September. So I suppose that would be our autumn.
Yeah.
And again, like Samhain, it's this idea that the veils between the dead and the living worlds start to get very transparent. And so the dead come. And, you know, so you have your ancestors who you love and you'll share feasts with them. But you also have something called hungry spirits. And these are either spirits who've done, you know, bad things or have been forgotten. And so we also set out food to appease these hungry ghosts, hungry
spirits.
Why are spirits hungry?
Spirits always seem to be hungry in like horror films and stuff. I don't understand. They don't get fed in the afterlife.
Oh, that's true. In China, they also give them paper Louis Vuitton bags and paper Ferraris at the tombs. So you burn these Louis Vuitton handbag for your...
It started as money, but it's gotten a little bit... Yeah.
So you go to a shop and you buy all these paper things like, oh, my husband liked Ferraris and he liked this. So they have the paper... They look like piñatas. And it's actually really bad luck to buy it for anything else. But I find that fascinating about the way that the Chinese approach death, that you'd go to somebody's tomb and burn paper bag.
Yeah, I mean, it's just we sweep our ancestors' tombs. I think that there's so much of death, and not necessarily in a negative way, but there is so much death, you know, in the way we just live our lives.
Yeah. Definitely. And tell us a little bit about the Spanish traditions then I'm going to pronounce Todos los Santos.
So Todos los Santos is the day of the saints, whether they're canonized or not. And I don't know if you know this, but in Spain, people have saints' names. So until Franco died, it was mandatory to have a saint's name. So I was born in the Basque Country and my name is Blanca, but my parents wanted to name me Suriñe, but they couldn't. It was illegal. So because you have a saint's name, saints are very important in Spain. And some people, instead of celebrating their birthday, you celebrate your saint's day. And on Todos los Santos, you have these huesos de santo that are made with marzipan. And you have the buñuelos, like the beignets. You have a lot of chestnuts. But it's a more solemn affair. You know, I think death in Spanish is more solemn. It's more boring. It has nothing like Mexico or Latin America. It's really or Halloween.
Yeah.
It's a very serious kind of dour approach to death.
Well, it's a happy time now. But it's interesting just to reflect on that. And while we're here, especially, and there's been so much amazing focus on food and Irish food here at the Samhain Festival in Meath. So we might as well move on to our main event. We're delighted to be joined by Alan and Lorena Kraus. We just spent the most fab afternoon at your home in Kahlua Castle in Clonmellon for a farm walk, which was part of the festival, but just also getting to see all of the animals and what you've done there and what you've achieved there, and also a beautiful tour of the inside of the castle. For anyone who hasn't been in, best you're jealous. It was absolutely amazing just to go around and see what you've done with it. It was beautiful. So what we want to do is, first of all, I suppose we're going to get to Kahlua, but we want to know about your journey to there, I guess, and your journey of meeting each other. And let's go back to Lorena. You're from Mexico City, and I know you said that Alan is also from Mexico City, but you both have very different backgrounds in growing up with food. Can you tell us, Lorena, first, what was food for you growing up in Mexico City? What was that like at home?
Thank you for having us here, Dee. I was born and I grew up in Mexico City, and it's very funny because when you live in Mexico, there's something that happens that we don't really have seasons. It's like one, we eat the same thing throughout the year. Maybe at some point, like in Christmas, you might have a specific fruit or a specific, but it's always throughout the year, we eat the same thing. So it was not until I was 15 years old, when I spent 1 year in Canada, that I realized that there were actually four seasons and that you eat whatever that season is giving you. Yeah. Or in the case of Canada, where the cold was so extreme, we would have minus 30 degrees. And I knew just at this time of year, they would start pickle everything, putting everything in jars. And yeah. And they would have two enormous freezers where they would cut whole cow and put it in the freezer. Oh, okay. And and throughout the winter, we would be eating out of that freezer.
Amazing.
They wouldn't have anything fresh.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about a few years ago. Yeah. So it was very, after I came back from that trip, all my vision about food and people and culture completely changed. Yeah. And I started to see a lot of the limitations that we were seeing in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And the possibilities that there was something more and different out there.
Yeah.
So for me, that was the journey.
Amazing. And Alan, for you growing up in Mexico City, because you have Austrian family as well and heritage, so was food very different for you? Is that a different picture growing
Completely.
Up?
Completely. Actually, every time that I would go to a friend's house, I couldn't eat everything. Oh, yeah. Because I was used to something totally different. I grew up in Mexico, but eating Wiener Schnitzel and Tafelspitz and whatever you can imagine. So, yeah, it was a totally different experience. And again, for me, that was completely normal. I thought that everybody ate like that until I had to go to a friend's house. And it was, okay, where's the senf, the mustard? And there wasn't any. Or there was something yellow called French that was disgusting. And this is not real mustard.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was very different than the traditional person growing up in Mexico.
Yeah.
And again, for me, it was the Austrian influence and also the Spanish-Catalan influence.
Yes.
Then, on the two sides of the family. So again, if you would have asked me as a child, then things like a suqueta or an escalivada would have been like perfectly normal. But I think I ate my first taco probably when I was 16.
Yeah. And who did the cooking for you growing up? Like, who was the main person in your home?
In my case, it was my mother, although my grandfather had no problem getting into the kitchen. And there were some things that had to be made by my grandfather to be original and typical. For example, roasting the goose at Christmas had to be my grandfather, not my mother.
Yeah. Amazing. And for you, Lorena, was your mom the main cook in the house? Or
the main cook in the house was my mom, but she didn't like cooking. And I think that made a big impact on me because, you see, I grew up not really appreciating good food until a little before I met Alan. But it was really Alan, the one who got me into good food and good wine and
nice.
And appreciating. And how it has evolved from there, obviously, it's very easy to get into fine and delicious food. But what we had developed from coming to Ireland, we started having relation with Ireland 22 years ago.
Yeah.
That's when we bought Kilua. But specifically when we started developing the farm, it's the importance of traceability, the importance of where the food is coming from. And now, to me, that is the most important thing. It's not only fine food. It's like, where is it coming from? What is behind this plate? What is behind this beef that we're eating? And I think that is the big thing,
yeah,
an evolution that I had, especially coming from since I arrived in Ireland.
Do you think that was an influence from Irish culture, of that traceability of knowing where our food comes from? That, like, when you came here, you felt that, you know, you realized that was something that's important to you and therefore was important to you as well? Or were you aware of that before?
I personally wasn't aware. I think he was, but I'm not going to speak for him. I wasn't aware. But then we started, like, I don't know, somebody came with local eggs. And I tried them and I said, wow, this tastes completely different. Where did you get them? And I was trying to, you know, give the name of the person that is sending you this egg. So you start noticing that not all eggs are equal.
Yeah.
okay, that there is a big difference. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, inadvertently, and because you had a lot of local producers and people that, you know, sell in markets, and they do taste different. The quality is different. And the reaction of my body to that food, it's completely different. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I had a frivolous question. Which one of you is the better cook? And yes. And
actually,
can you name
my journey
dish?
To food is very funny because I was an incredibly naughty boy. I was an only child and unbelievably naughty. So one of the few ways of keeping me under control was sending me to the kitchen to the most ignoble jobs. So they would send me to visit my great aunts, who were five ladies, all in their 80s or more.
Spinsters.
The only way in which they could control me was put me in the kitchen and make me work. So I actually learned techniques, and I learned 19th century techniques from them. And then about age 13, I saw in the school library a book called The Great Chefs of France. And it was about the then three Michelin star restaurants, but very much at the beginning of this. So Fernand Pointe was still cooking in Vienne. Paul Bocuse was a young man who had just opened a restaurant in Lyon. So it was quite a long time ago. Alain Chapelle, been all the great chefs of the time. And I read it, became fascinated by it. And at the end, it had recipes, but not recipes like you find in a cookbook. It was exactly the type of recipe that a chef like that would give you, sort of a very vague description of a dish. And I would get into the kitchen on Saturdays, and I would cook for the family on Saturdays. And it started turning out reasonably well, and it was very enjoyable. And since then, I started cooking. Then I figured out that it was a great way to have dates, invite somebody and cook for them. And then I actually used to make ice cream for Lorena when I first met her. And yeah, it evolved from there, but I'm the cook at home. I cook every day.
Going back to what you were saying, cooking in your past, in Mexico City, was it difficult to get the ingredients that you wanted?
It wasn't difficult at all, because first of all, again, there was a German shop that my grandfather used to shop from, and the rest of the things are not that difficult to get. I mean, Austrian cookery is not that elaborate. It only becomes very elaborate when it comes to baking. Baking, and again, I learned to bake quite early, and there are things that are simple. I mean, anybody can make a passable blintzer torta, but if you want to make something more elaborate, then I've actually had my wife helping me make for my son an Esterházy torta. That requires a lot of work. That is something that does require time and effort and putting really a solid, at least afternoon, if not full day, with somebody helping you in the kitchen.
Can you actually describe to our listeners, and also for me, what the torta was?
Sure. Look, the way that you do an Esterházy torta is you first grind your almonds, mix them with egg whites, and you actually make really thin pancakes, which you have to bake one by one, and bake about a dozen of them. Then, separately, you make your hazelnut cream, which you're going to layer in between this very thin pancakes made with an egg white and almond. Then on top of it, you're going to put an icing that is fundamentally made with icing sugar and lemon. Then once that is done, you're going to cover the sides and put almonds in it as if it was like a porcupine in a way. And then on top of it, you're going to make your chocolate glazing. You make circles, and once that you make your concentric circles, with a stick or the tip of a knife or whatever, you're going to turn them into something that looks a bit like a cobweb. So it's a lot of work. It's delicious. And again, once that you finish, it's not ready to eat. You put it away in the fridge for at least a day, and then two or three days later, it's even better. So it's a lot of work. It's fantastic, but it's a lot of work. It's the sort of thing that you generally find in pastry shops in Vienna. And again, people in Austria are very peculiar about their cakes. They tend to if they offer something, you have to return the plate with something in it. You can never return the plate empty. And if they send you a Dovostorte or some elaborate cake and you return it with something like a Linzertorte, people are going to be deeply offended. It's like, I worked a full day for you and you worked 45 minutes for me. That's not fair.
I really want to go on asking questions about cooking, but I wanted to ask you about Ireland and food. And you've been coming to Ireland, I guess, since 1999. Have you seen the evolution, or tell us about your experiences of Irish food and Irish producers? Because I think it's been there's been so many changes. I think the first time I came to Ireland was in 98, so the same. And I'm just constantly amazed at so many exciting things happening.
Well, I've been deeply impressed by the change, not only in food, but in other aspects. When we arrived in 1999, towns like Clonmelon, where Killua is, or Kells, they were like ghost towns. They were really sad, you know. And now you see them, and they're beautiful towns, and they're like thriving. And so the change from when we arrived to how they are now has been so completely incredible. And I'm very happy because, as I said, I have always had a very, very deep love for Kells. I have always think Kells is my hometown. My son used to come to Headford School. So obviously I was in Kells every day, dropping him. And I developed such a deep connection with Kells and obviously with Clonmelon. And the evolution in those towns had been so massive. And we have seen the same thing at a bigger level in food. Maybe in that respect, Alan might have better insight.
Well, being the cook, I have to say that shopping here 20 years ago was a difficult and sad experience.
Oh, yeah.
Because you would go and there wasn't that much variety of anything, and a lot of things that I wanted, I couldn't find them. And then somebody pointed out that Kevin Sheridan had opened a shop where I could find really nice cheese, and I was really excited about it. And I started going there, buying stuff. And then Super Value completely changed from being a supermarket that looked more like a hard discounter to actually having then specialty foods, having a good variety. So even from shopping, the experience has been very different. Restaurant wise, again, massive change. And when we started coming, not only here, but my first experience then in 2000, when we moved to London from New York, I remember, and again, the Goldman Sachs canteen is probably not the best place to savor great food. But in those days, and first day that I go down for lunch, and I see they're making pasta. I thought, well, that cannot be too bad. So I asked for a bowl. And the next thing is the guys that are serving it. Yes. Chips on your pasta, mate. As he was pouring them, I was, What the hell is this man doing? Chips on my pasta. What is this? And nearly want to throw it back at him. And anyway, here, when we came, again, the typical thing was 20 things piled on one plate and with five different types of potatoes in them and not much care. Then we started seeing an evolution. I remember, again, distinctly, shortly after we had come here, when Porrick White opened the Forge in Canary Ross, and we started going there. And again, it was really nice to see that somebody was actually caring to do something nicely. And then obviously the change in Dublin been amazing. Been, you know, I think that we went for the first time to Patrick Ilbohan, it had just opened, and then obviously Square One and then all the great restaurants that have appeared. So it's a massive change compared to what it was.
Do you like to eat out in restaurants like in Dublin? Do you still travel up and go out and eat out a lot?
Yes, I actually very peculiar in my eating habits. I eat only once a day at lunchtime. So we used to go out more for dinner. Now, since I only eat once a day, we do a lot less of that. And again, unfortunately, many of the better restaurants here don't open for lunch, which is something that I absolutely hate. Because, again, I find that if I eat at night, my sleep suffers dramatically. And when I eat, because I eat only once a day, I eat. It's an embarrassing, it's a true embarrassment looking at me eating. And my friends say that it's cheaper to buy me a car than to invite me for lunch.
You were going to say something.
Yes, I wanted to make a special mention on the evolution of food to Olivia Duff. Because a few years ago, I cannot remember which year it was, she said, oh, we're doing this of the Boyne Valley, you know, and we're going to do a dinner at Hedford School. So I remember it was the first time we came across something a little more sophisticated. And I did like it. I did like it. And I thought, oh, this is very good. But
you
then... But it's not that I was not impressed at the ingredients. I was not impressed at the cooking of them.
Okay.
But then, I don't know, a few years later, we had another invitation to head for our Arms Hotel.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was similar to what we had yesterday. So we sat down. It was a long table. And then I started eating every dish. And I just couldn't believe it. The quality of how it was served, mm-hmm. of everything. You know, I saw, oh, black pudding. No, I'm not going to have it. And then I said, I'll taste it. Oh, my God, I've never tasted such a most delicious black pudding as I remember. I don't think it was Tom Doherty's.
Hugh McGuire's.
And every dish. And I said, wow, I've never imagined coming this far.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I saw the evolution. I'm telling you, that day, with every dish that we ate, I was more and more impressed at what the Boyne Valley has done for.
Yeah, the quality of producers. The quality of the Boyne Valley is amazing.
But also, if they do it right, it's just the best, really. And we've seen the best. And now Ireland, it's up there, I think.
I Know the Face is a movie podcast on the Headstuff Podcast Network, hosted by me, Stephen Porzio.
And me, Andrew Carroll. Our show is all about character actors, the type of performers you'll see pop up in supporting roles in blockbusters, the type of people you know the faces but not the names.
Each episode we pick one particular character actor and discuss a couple of their movies, shining a light on the performer's career while giving listeners plenty of movie recommendations. So the show is a must for cinema lovers.
Subscribe to I Know That Face wherever you get podcasts and follow us on Twitter at IKnowThatFacePone.
Well, you yourselves have become producers, and I suppose we should go on to Kahlua and ask you a little bit about that. But before we kind of, I suppose, talk about Kahlua itself and the food produce that you make there, tell us a little bit about how you came to Kahlua, how you found it, and why you decided to buy it.
Well, the truth is that it was sheer madness. And when my second daughter was born, I took my eldest daughter on a trip. I thought my mother-in-law is going to come, and she and I didn't get along that well. So I thought, let me take my daughter, and I leave Lorena with the baby and her mother. And we went to Scotland, and we stayed in a castle. And Alexander was 3 at the time. When Lorena thought that I was hopping mad. She had not turned 4. She was about to turn 4. She thought that I was hopping mad crossing the Atlantic with a 3-year-old. Anyway, we had the best of times. So a couple of years later, she said, Daddy, you have to take me again to a castle. So we came to Ireland. We stayed in Dromoland. And by then, I mean, convincing a 5-year-old that buying a castle is a good idea is not that difficult. And Alexander and I decided that we should buy a castle. So we started looking. We visited a few properties. Nothing that really caught my eye. Or met my budget at the time, which was very limited. And then back in New York, we saw on the internet that Kahlua Castle was for sale. So I called somebody on the other end of the line, spoke a strange language, nothing similar to English that I ever heard. So I thought, okay, I have to go investigate because it's not being very helpful. Came to Clonmelon, met Thomas Kane. And it took us the better part of 3 years to negotiate price. And I would keep coming almost every quarter. As I said, we graduated from tea to whiskey. First, tea was an offer. By the end, whiskey was an offer. His mother, the late Mary Kane, used to make soda bread and smoked salmon sandwiches for me and baked the apple tart the traditional way.
Lovely.
So we became very good friends and eventually agreed on a price. And we also agreed that when the time was right, Tom would sell me the land, and everybody told me I was a complete idiot thinking that was ever going to happen. Tom was a gentleman, and that happened. He sold me the land eventually. And when their mother died, then his younger brother, Michael, actually stayed in the old bungalow. Now Michael's stepdaughter is my son's girlfriend.
Oh,
so it has all
nice.
Ended up in a very happy note. And that's how it eventually happened. And we bought the ruin. And I distinctly remember Lorena asking me, do you have money to do this project? I said, you know the answer. I don't have the money. But at the time, I was 40 years old. I thought, I hope I can make more money in my life.
Yeah.
So did I have a goal of finishing it or anything in mind? No. I thought, let's embark on this and see where the road takes us.
Wow. What was your reaction to that, Lorena, that it might not even get finished? That you're just, let's see what happens. Did you go with the dream as well, as much as Alan was selling it to you?
I think that has been the secret why we've been together 33 years. that he says crazy things and I said, okay.
And one of the things we learned today, so for our listeners, it took you 21 years, is it, or 22 years? 22 years to renovate, and it's an absolute remarkable renovation of the castle itself, but even the grounds and the farm and everything are just absolutely beautiful. So tell us, myth or truth, Walter Raleigh planted the very first potato ever in Ireland on your land, on that piece of land.
Of course, makes wonderful sense. Raleigh sails to Virginia, gets a potato, sails back to Ireland, doesn't stop in Kerry where he owned land, goes to Dublin, gets on a horse or a carriage or goes know what, rides to Westmeath, climbs a hill, plants a potato. If people say that's what happened, it must have happened. Now, the reality is somewhat different. The Chapmans did arrive to Ireland with Walter Raleigh, as soldiers with Raleigh, and they came from Leicester. They ended up settling in what today is the Dingle Peninsula. And they stayed there until they actually lost their lands as a result of the downfall of Raleigh. And then eventually they became soldiers of fortune, really. They fought during the English Civil War with Inchiquin for the Royalists. When Inchiquin was defeated, rather than joining the Irish side of the revolution, they decided to join Cromwell. And eventually, in lieu of payment, Cromwell gave them the lands of Killua, and they acquired a bit more land from other soldiers. But 100 years later, saying that you had received your land from Cromwell was not that great. Cromwell was not such a nice person. So they had to make a better story. And Sir Thomas Chapman, who was never lacking in imagination, said that they had received the lands of Killua from their maternal ancestor, Sir Walter Raleigh. So Raleigh had now evolved from being the general or captain or whatever that they came with to Ireland to their maternal ancestor. And he gave them the lands. And of course, they had to build a folly, which was the old Killua castle where Sir Walter Raleigh spent the night when he planted the potato. And then they erected the obelisk in the memory of Raleigh. And then, of course, the locals added the legend.
I love the fact that there's still sort of dodgy, imaginative people like in the past, now.
Yeah, exactly.
Never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
This is it, absolutely. And tell us a bit about the farm and about the animals that you have there for our listeners, and also then how you've become producers as well and what you produce there.
Sure. Look, Killua, like many other places, have been farmed very intensively. And also, the land had suffered a lot because in the 1920s to the 1940s, it had been a golf club. So all the timber had been taken off the land, all the hedges had been taken off. So it had become what Anthony, our farm manager, calls the coldest farm in Ireland. And we started working on that, trying to make sure that we could regenerate the land as much as possible. So we planted 9 kilometers of hedges, about 8,000 trees, tried to recover the parkland nature of the landscape, put in 3 ponds, stretched the lake. So massive amount of work, first just to recreate, again, a proper space where you could farm in a more intelligent way. Then we thought, okay, if we had gone through all this investment, let's try to do things slightly different, take a few risks, and not go to maximize this year's return on cash, but actually try to think, I'm an economist by training, try to think about capital. And nobody in their sane mind would destroy their capital to produce more this year. Then you try to keep whatever you're doing, your plant and equipment, your machinery, whatever it is, try to keep it safe. In the case of agriculture, then your main capital is your land and your livestock. So we said, okay, let's make sure that we start by investing in the right capital and making sure that we protect our capital first. Then we'll see what yield we get from that, but let's protect the capital first. So stopped using fertilizers, stopped using pesticides, stopped using any form of weed killers, and upgrade significantly the livestock. And again, we realized very quickly, trial and error, experimenting, we saw that commercial sheep, for example, got ill all the time. When it was not excess cobalt, it was excess selenium, it was lack of copper, it was always a problem, and always there was somebody ready, usually from Monsanto, to sell you what the solution would be. And I said, okay, thank you very much, not eager to buy it. And then next experiment was, let's try with native breeds and how they do. And immediately we found out that those didn't get sick. Those lived very well. Those could actually be wintered out. So significant savings all around, everywhere. And animals that on top of that and are better adapted to the environment, live better and don't harm the environment, at least not as much. So we went for red deer, Irish mole cattle, few dextrous, Jacob sheep, and as an experiment, again, more first thinking about conservation. But of course, we will eat them eventually, the old Irish goats.
Do you have a favorite meat that you rear? You know, if you were to pick one, would it be the venison? Would it be, you know, the beef? Which one and why?
First of all, let me say, as a meat producer, and I take this very seriously, and I think that meat should be a luxury product. It's not something to be eaten every day. I think that for the health of the planet in first place, and for our own personal health, I think that meat should not be mass produced and should be a luxury item. Having said that, I love meat, and I must say that I still believe that venison is the meat of kings. And if you ask me, I would actually go for the neck, slow cooked. To me, that is the epitome of nice meat.
Thank you.
And he's moved on to cooking. Obviously, cooking is his favorite pastime. We wanted to ask you about your next venture. So you're moving, you're staying as producers, but you're planning to open a new restaurant and you've brought some Spanish chefs. Can you tell us a little bit about your project and what ignited that desire to be restaurateurs in essence?
Well, Blanca, first of all, I thought that in the food chain, obviously, the more you move to value added, the better off you are. And it's a hard road. And we first had the animals, then again, capital investments. So we invested in having our own processing plant, which, given all the EU requirements and whatever, it's an incredibly costly affair. But, okay, it's done. I would love to move into ready-to-eat items. And again, I think that coming from Spain, you can appreciate that the variety that you can have is far more than just salami and chorizo. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is still a lot of way to go here in that area. And it's a great opportunity. But again, it's a costly affair. So it will happen eventually. But it is something that it's for the future, probably not for the very distant future, but it's for the future. And then the next step, obviously, was a restaurant where we could actually showcase some of our own products, but also products from our partners in the Boyne Valley and other producers in Ireland. And I thought very much of the idea of having what you would call in Spain, cocina de producto. So cookery based on local produce, where the local produce is really the star of a meal. And again, I spoke with Olivia at the time and with many friends with Porrick White, and finding young chefs in Ireland right now who are truly interested in producing high quality food rather than just an institutional job working for a school or a hospital or whatever, it's very, very difficult, very hard. So after looking unsuccessfully and finding either the guys that are more interested in their Instagram or the guys that are, quite frankly, are just institutional cooks, I thought, okay, let me try other avenues. And funny enough, a friend of mine has a lady working with her, and her brother was a young guy working with Jean Roque at Le Cellier. So she introduced me to him, and then he introduced me to a friend of his working at AVAC with Jordi Cruz. And eventually, the two guys are the ones that you have now at Kilua. And again, I think that if you give opportunity to young people, it can be very interesting. And what I thought is, let's go for something. It's not going to be doing Spanish food in Ireland, but it's going to be cookery based on sort of traditional methods, which are fundamentally French, but with a nod to Ireland, both in terms of the local ingredients, but also applying new and traditional techniques to Irish dishes and trying to do a slightly more elaborate version of them, but staying true to the real recipe. And that is what we're trying to do. We have been getting the place ready and doing just private dry runs for ourselves. In the near future, I want to do a soft opening so that we can start working for the public, but in a limited way. And then when we're ready and when we can have our staff trained and really feel that we're ready for prime time, then we'll do the real opening.
And we met the chefs today, and they're really lovely men, and they even cooked for us a little bit and just a few snacks, and it was really lovely to see what they're doing. I can already see...
We can't disclose what they were
showing. I'm not going to say. Obviously, I wouldn't say anything like that. But no, just to even see a flair there of... you know, how they're exploring the ingredients and the food. And I hope that they, and I think they will bring something exciting, you know, to the ingredients. I know that they have visited Ballymakenny as well, down to see Maria and her husband on the farm and work with the potatoes. So lots of different producers to explore. Is it important for you that they explore the Irish producers and Irish food? And are you helping them in that journey of getting to know Irish food? Because I presume... coming from Spain, they may not have as good a knowledge of Irish food or what's available here to them.
And it has been very funny because it has been an interaction that goes two ways. And Porrick has been introducing them to Irish producers and Irish food and better versions of Irish food. And there have been fascinating conversations around our kitchen table and with Porrick asking them about techniques and whatever. And Chavi in particular, was saying how they use in AVAC sous vide to actually deal with huge numbers of customers, and things have to be cooked to precision. And it was very interesting for those of you who were yesterday at the dinner. Porrick actually cooked the moiled beef sous vide 24 hours at 52 degrees, and then yesterday just brought temperature at 56 degrees for an hour, and finished it just by searing it. So again. The secret of having beef that was not what I called wedding beef, that great stuff that has been cooked beyond human consumption and that is drier than usual. Shoe sole was precisely applying sous vide to be able to manage. Again, I think there are nicer ways to cook the meat, to be perfectly honest with you. But I think that if you have to cook steak for, I don't know, 150 people, however many we were, then it is a great way of dealing with it. Because certainly if you roast it, the chances are that it would have been dried beyond consumption would have been very high.
Is it a dream come true for you, having spoken to you for this podcast episode, you know, to hear your love of food and your background in cooking and how much you enjoy cooking in particular, Alan, is it a dream come true to now, well, own your own restaurant and be able to do all these things and be part of it from the conception to when it launches and seeing, being able to see people come in and enjoy it? Is that kind of a dream of your own?
Let's say that it doesn't come as a surprise. I've been talking about this for the longest time. So it's not something that I came up with last year. It's something that has been in my mind forever. And again, it's a sort of thing that you have it here, you have to turn it a million times before you get to the right concept, before you find the right team, and before you can roll it out. So it's work in progress, but it's definitely not recent work in progress.
And Lorena, is where do you kind of envision Kahlua Castle in the future? I mean, how do you see it in 5 years or 10 years in progression of your journey with it?
Yes. One of the things that I like the most about what we're doing in Kahlua is that everything is connected and everything is a complement of everything else. And even though at the beginning it sounds like something completely undetached, like the restoration we did and bringing back the building and doing the landscape, it sounds like, oh, it doesn't really, but it is. It's all part of healing this land. We heal the building, we're healing the land, we're connecting everything together so it has an image and a meaning all in one, not just detached. So I think I think it's just going to come round circle. Yes, hopefully the restaurant will do well, and we want to continue connected to the restaurant and connected to the restoration to keep on restoring the rest of the lands, have orchards, have vegetables maybe, have other things. So it's all part of all this healing of this land that has taken place in 22 years.
And one thing people think, 22 years has been a long time. And the plan has been more like a 200-year plan. So in even sort of something that I always like to mention, the way that we hold the property, it's through the family foundation, where the children and the descendants are the beneficiaries, but only to the extent that they want or can keep Kahlua. What they can't do is put their parents in an old people's home and sell it. And again, if at any point in time they're not interested or they can't do it or there are none of them left, the ultimate beneficiary is the Irish state, because the idea was that we wouldn't do this to then see it auctioned off and the collection, the art collection, dismembered and whatever. The idea was build it to stay. So the ultimate beneficiary should be the community. And again, we were, I think it was 2007, if my memory serves me right, when the National Trust for Ireland was created. And 2004, okay, there you go. And Terry Dooley at the University of Maynooth made a big event, and Bertie Ahern at the time went and inaugurated it and whatever, and then it never got funded. I thought, okay, how can you actually deal with this? Well, make them the beneficiary of Kahlua. And again, the idea is try to have a reasonable endowment to go with it so that it's not a burden to anybody. But if it's a burden, it should be a burden to the Irish state, because it should be a benefit for the community and it should be something that stays there for a long time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, and in the spirit of that Alan is talking about, we also, in every step of the way, we are trying to make everything that it doesn't become a burden. We are, when we were doing the castle, we have geothermal energy and we have solar panels. So we looked in every step of the way that whatever we did was not going to be a burden for future generations. So because these places went into disrepair and they went into oblivion because of the burden they represented. And this is one of the things that we're doing in Quilua. Not only we're creating sources where it can sustain itself, but also in the case of energy and, you know, heating and whatever, we're almost fuel free, or how would you say?
Self-sufficient.
Self-sufficient,
yeah.
Which I think it's a very important part to give it a future.
Did you have any other questions for the guys? It's been an absolute delight speaking to you, and I love that you speak about being such a, you know, that the community is as important to you as you are to it. I know from speaking to Olivia and others here over the festival that, you know, everyone's so excited by Clua to have it as part of Boyne Valley and you know, and by you and everything you're doing with such enthusiasm and passion. And it really comes across when you're speaking to you. I love your stories and just wish you the best for the future with it. And thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. And one last thing that I'd like to mention
is
precisely being well integrated to the community. For example, during COVID, we started opening the grounds to the people. And one of the wonderful things is that instead of us having to chase people and tell them behave properly, don't litter, don't do this, don't do that, it's the people of Clonmelon. And the more elderly they are, the more they take the role of being the enforcers and making sure that everybody behaves properly, which is wonderful because instead of you having to be fighting with people, you have a community on your side.
Excellent. I love that.
Thank you so much. It was really lovely meeting you. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.